From Inside Higher Ed, this is This Week at Inside Higher Ed, the informed and essential conversation about the week's news in higher education. This Week is made possible through the generous support of our sponsors, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, Oracle, and 2U.
Greetings from This Week at Inside Higher Ed. At the City University of New York, a new faculty hire has been handed a transformative challenge for the university. And the Jack Kent Cook Foundation plans to develop a new software application that will fuel the college aspirations and assist access for low-income students. Hi, this is Casey Green. I'm the moderator for This Week at Inside Higher Ed, where we go behind and beyond the news to provide the informative and engaging conversation about what really matters in higher education. So welcome all. And ahead of our conversation, please note that you can post your thoughts about these conversations on the comments section of the This Week page, insidehighered.com/thisweek. We begin our conversation today talking about a transformative hire at the City University of New York. Boards and trustees hire presidents hoping that they might transform the college or university. Presidents and provosts hire faculty hoping that they might transform individual departments or programs. However, earlier this year, the City University of New York recruited Kathy Davidson, a noted humanities scholar, technology advocate, and interdisciplinary evangelist who held two endowed professorships at Duke to transform teaching and learning across the massive CUNY system. 11 senior colleges, 7 community colleges, an honors college, 5 graduate and professional schools. At CUNY, Davidson is the director of the Futures Initiative, which is charged with promoting interdisciplinary work and innovative pedagogies. Davidson says the Futures Initiative is engaged in an array of big ideas about teaching and learning and the future of higher education at CUNY and beyond. And we're pleased to welcome Kathy Davidson, Distinguished Professor and Director of the Futures Initiative at City University of New York, and Scott Jasek, the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. Kathy Davidson, let me begin with you. What is the Future Initiatives at CUNY and how will it transform the university?
Well, the Futures Initiative is what people make it. So it's going to be transformative because I am joining here of faculty and students who have more energy and creativity and dedication to the art of teaching and the art of research and the art of scholarship than I've seen anywhere. I think CUNY is the hidden behemoth gem of New York City. The tunnels and the bridges should say, welcome to New York, the most expensive city in the country, the worst income inequality, but here you can get a great education at a very low price. You can send your kid to college here. And so the transformation is really working to bring and to showcase and to coordinate and galvanize and inspire as much of these energies to become public and vocal and articulate as possible.
Scott, you have covered as a reporter for a long period of time announcements about transformative appointments. What is it about Kathy's arrival in New York that makes this a little bit different than others that you've watched in the past?
Well, there are a few things that make this interesting to me. One is the breadth and diversity within CUNY. You hear a lot of talk about individual institutions launching this or that initiative, but within CUNY you have 2-year, 4-year, undergraduate, graduate, all sorts of different kinds of programs. So to attempt this at a mega diverse system that serves so many low-income first-generation students, I think is notable. I'm also really intrigued by the fact that Kathy is talking about changing PhD education at the same time, because any sort of change, I think, requires new ideas in those who will be teaching students in the future. So it's those combination of things that has put this project on my radar screen.
Kathy, you may bring new energy to these activities, and CUNY may essentially give you a great launch pad and a great laboratory to do these things. But these are issues that we've grappled with in academia for a long time, the challenge of interdisciplinary work, the challenge of leveraging technology, the challenge of pedagogy. These are continuing conversations, and oftentimes they launch with great fanfare, but they don't necessarily sustain themselves. How will this initiative be different?
Well, Scott, I think, put his finger on it. My focus, I'm at the Graduate Center, which is literally the center of New York. I walk out my front door of the Graduate Center, and there's the Empire State Building. So it's the best location on earth to think about being the center of change. But I'm going to be teaching with the former president of the Graduate Center, who was the interim chancellor of the entire CUNY system, Bill Kelly. I'm going to be teaching a class next semester. This is just our first class effort as a, in the classroom, called Mapping the Futures of Higher Education for PhD students who are all currently teaching in the colleges. And what we're hoping, there's a permission form we're going to be doing, so we're hoping to curate 15 graduate students from 15 departments, 15 fields, who are teaching in 15 different colleges. Will it work that perfectly? I'm sure not. But we're going to try for that. And every week, one of the students will explain why they are dedicating their passionate life as a graduate student to the research in their field. And they'll be explaining it to 14 graduate students who don't know that field. And one of the tricks we're going to be using is to say, do something innovative to make us understand why you're doing what you're doing, why you're committing your life to this, which is something's rarely explained by academics. Why are we doing this? Why do we voluntarily commit our life to this topic? Then the teachers will go to their 15 classes that week and try this innovative learning method, whether it's something online, whether it's an experiment, whether it's something they're actually doing in their classrooms. And we're building a public website where those 300 or 400 students in the classes out in the CUNY system, LaGuardia Community College it might be, or Hofstra or Baruch, one of the community colleges, can respond that week to what we're doing on a public website. We hope to have town halls at each of the colleges. We're also creating a CUNY map of New York where each of the students, the first data point on our map, will each student with properly anonymized data, of course, will put themselves on the map and then start to create the map of higher education in the city of New York themselves. So it's not top down. It's very much peers responding and taking responsibility together for changing the shape of higher education.
Scott, let me ask you a variation of the question I just posed to Kathy. The history of efforts to promote interdisciplinary work and technology and new pedagogies often fall on younger faculty members, and at the same time, many understand that if they go in that direction, they typically put themselves at risk in terms of review, promotion, and tenure, because it's off the straight and narrow path. Will this initiative be different in terms of the way it's launching and the kind of efforts that Kathy and her colleagues are bringing into it, and potentially the protection that senior people at CUNY are going to offer young faculty who go down this path?
Well, we might not know for sure until 10 years from now, when these PhD students have found great jobs and are coming up for tenure. But the issue is a key one, because I meet lots of faculty members whose hearts are in interdisciplinarity, but who have been told somewhere along the line, don't go interdisciplinary until you have tenure. Or, you know, don't be too interdisciplinary on the job market when you're looking for your first job. Now, the ideas that Kathy is pushing are ideas that so many people say are vital to academe. So there's certainly a constituency for it. But the test will be, you know, what happens to these people. Now, I think having a high-profile evangelist makes a big difference, and so that's what we'll be watching.
And Kathy, let me take that one back to you. You've worked with young academics in your prior life at Duke, a long history of interdisciplinary work, and yet the data would suggest that those who try to put a foot in two departments or do interdisciplinary work are often penalized by each, as opposed to being recognized and rewarded by one. What about the situation at CUNY will make this work, where it has struggled in other environments?
That's just the question that keeps me awake at night, Casey, and I've got two answers. One, I've read widely in the literature of risk and what sometimes is called grit, and what we know is the single biggest thing that fails people, that lead to people's failure, is not taking a risk. It's doing something that they're bored with or that they hate because it's the safe course. The numbers are eye-popping of when people do ethnographic survey data of people who succeed and people who fail. People who succeed are people who love so passionately what they do that they're willing to blur the distinction between life and work and commit themselves to doing it. And I bet I'm talking to two people, you and Scott, who know exactly what I mean. If something's your baby, your idea is your baby, your research is your baby, you're going to be a success at it. So we have lots of data in many, many, many fields on that. So that's part of my evangelism, is teaching students to love what they love and to articulate what they love. The second part is we're planning on doing, and I do this around the country all the time, both in business and in academia, not just in for English teachers by any means, but in all fields, including the sciences and in the business world, is I do a lot of workshops that looks at the affordances of your job. And affordances is a term from 1970s cognitive neuroscience taken up in the 80s by computer science, which means in any situation you have to see what can be done because the institution has the affordances that allow it to be done and what can't be done. And then you have to look at your own human affordances. This is my twist to this. And think about what you can do and what you can't do. And to find the sweet spot or the place in the Venn diagram where there's an overlap between what can be done and what you can do. One of the saddest things I ever see in higher education is when somebody is a brilliant person being beaten down at an institution that doesn't fit them. And sometimes I think if you took a risk and went to an institution that might be further afield from what you thought you wanted to do or from status or in a different part of the country, you would be a star. And I see that over and over again. So one thing I do is give people strategies for translating their work. I also am the first person that says, that school stinks for you. You're being beaten down. You're being eaten alive. Look someplace else. And to see somebody who feels like they're being penalized because of what they do suddenly flourish in another environment, I think is a healthy thing for all of us. We all have to remember that there are situations in which we thrive and situations in which we don't. I hope in 10 years there are many, many more situations out there that look at people's individual gifts and help them to thrive.
Scott, Kathy projects energy and evangelism about her mission. But let me again turn to you in terms of her words, what you can do and can it be done. Is there something unique about this moment at CUNY, which outsiders might view as being highly politicized, complex, large, the four-year campuses, the graduate centers, the community colleges, that again make this a unique opportunity at CUNY that might not work in other contexts or other institutions?
There may well be. We've written about a program where the graduate center sends its PhD students to do some of their teaching at community colleges. Now, that's really significant because most PhD students are obviously at research universities, and they learn to teach by being TAs at research universities. So they're generally teaching students who are just like they were. In the CUNY program at community colleges, these PhD students get to find out if they might have that passion that Kathy was talking about to teach students who may be very different from themselves at a community college setting. And then, frankly, if they don't like that, they can go to one of CUNY's four-year institutions. But I think the structure of CUNY with this mix of colleges may create the opportunities in terms of some of the interdisciplinary teaching may be great at CUNY's Honors College or City College or Hunter. Other techniques may be essential for a community college helping students who are still facing remedial challenges. And that mix and match approach within doctoral education is actually quite rare.
So Kathy, the seminar that you talked about earlier with the 15 students going out, you know, this very much sounds like what the technologists would call the network effect. And it's not arithmetic. It's, you know, essentially exponential in terms of the potential impact. But there's this question of scale, and particularly in an environment, if I'm a faculty member who is supervising one of those graduate students in your seminar in one of those departments, I mean, at the end of the day, faculty act out of enlightened self-interest. How will this benefit me, and how will this benefit my students in the context of everything else that I have to do? If I'm one of those students that's at one of the CUNY campuses, if I'm one of the faculty members, you know, how will this scale, and 2 years from now or 5 years from now, how will it benefit individual faculty members in terms of changing pedagogy, fostering interdisciplinary work at CUNY?
Well, we figure, first of all, I have to say that in addition to this being a great model for teaching and learning at CUNY, we're at an amazing moment. The Graduate Center and CUNY itself have hired people in the last few years from Cambridge, Harvard, Penn, Duke, Virginia, top universities, and I think part of it is because we all are concerned about, I mean, Paul Krugman most famously came from Princeton to CUNY. We're very concerned about income inequality, and it really feels, I mean, I had an amazing career at Duke. I love Duke, and I have nothing negative to say about my time there. what I love about the Graduate Center is there's educational equality at a time when there's such vast income inequality. What I'm finding here is, rather than people saying, what about me, I'm overwhelmed by how many people are writing me. There is no time, day or night, that I turn on, and I work kind of 24/7, that I turn on my email where there isn't somebody, a student, a faculty member, an administrator from one of the CUNY campuses, community colleges, the Graduate Center, saying, how can I be part of this? The issue is there's so much energy and there's so much already happening here that if all we do in our map is just write what existed before this supposedly transformative Kathy Davidson arrived, that's a transformation. The only thing CUNY doesn't have is a spotlight showing how great it is. My mother-in-law went to Hunter College in the 50s as an art student and studied with the great modernist painter Robert Motherwell for $25 a semester. People often will say, oh, that was back when CUNY was great. CUNY is great again. It is great again. I wish the faculty were paid more. I wish there were more remuneration. But the state and city of New York are supporting the City University of New York, 250,000 students this year, over 250,000 students this year. If you put in part-timers and returning students and our free senior citizens program at some of the campuses, 500,000 students. Our graduate students teach 200,000 students a year. That's eye-popping. So I think the energies are there. I'm not worried about people saying what for me because I'm not an administrator. This is an entirely voluntary program. Anyone who doesn't want to doesn't have to be part of it. But I think actually everybody I've met so far is really happy that their graduate students are going to get this kind of engaged, independent training that doesn't take away from the research, but says you are doing something so important that you contribute right now to society in your teaching, and your students at 18 or 64, whatever age they are when they're coming to school, are already contributing to society. That's what higher education isn't a democracy. Learning how to make a short-term sacrifice voluntarily, giving your time to learn, to be in a classroom in order for some pretty nebulous good in the future. That's what the basic structure of higher education is. That's the basic structure of a democracy.
All right, so Kathy,
Yes.
Let's talk about that future. 5 years from now, Scott said 10, but let's take five. What metrics do you want to be judged on in terms of what the initiative has accomplished and what you've accomplished in terms of pedagogy, interdisciplinary work, and technology? What are the appropriate metrics in terms of the mission that you have, the energies that you're devoting to this, and your efforts to infect others to share your enthusiasm for these kinds of changes and this transformation?
So one metric I would like is participation. We expect to reach 400 students this year. Those 400 students, who passes one of the classes, will become a mentor next year. And, you know, we want open study groups. We know that study groups, even at Harvard, but also at the poorest areas in for junior high school students that we've studied through the MacArthur Foundation Digital Media and Learning Research Initiatives, study groups are the single biggest determinant of success. It would be fantastic if we could point to retention rates in the classes taught by our students that are higher than retention rates, which are always a problem in stressed environments with community college students or other students who are holding down two jobs, et cetera, et cetera. If our graduation rates and our completion rates in our courses are higher, that's an amazing metric. If we have people voluntarily lining up to teach in the program, the first year it's me and Bill. If we have 10 teachers the next year, that's great. We hope to offer fellowships in the future where teachers from the colleges can come and be part of the core. They're teaching with the graduate students, and they will be teaching 15 students who will be teaching 15 courses. So we do expect, you used the phrase network effect, we do expect a network effect exponentially and some real numbers. I've got demographers and statisticians working as part of my team, and we'll be charting and studying everything in a very public way and getting feedback constantly in a public way.
And Scott, Kathy has mentioned some metrics that she wants to use. What are the other metrics that outsiders, whether they're journalists like you or academics at other institutions that are watching this, will be using in terms of the effort at CUNY?
I would agree with the metrics Kathy has outlined. I would also love to be doing surveys a few years from now and asking both new faculty and senior faculty, what technique are you using in your course that you never would have used before? I would love to ask them, do you feel you're getting appropriate support, whether it's technology support or just affirmation from your department chair that these things are making a difference. Are they working? And so I think in addition to things like retention and participation, there's an element of this that I'd love to see, and I think that'll come from individual teaching and learning experiences.
Great. Kathy Davidson and Scott Jasek, thank you both for an interesting conversation about what seems to be a transformative moment at CUNY. We continue our conversation today talking about college aspirations and access enabled by technology. Former New York City Schools Chancellor Harold Levy, recently appointed as the Executive Director of the Jack Kent Cook Foundation, this week announced the foundation's plans to launch a new initiative that would leverage technology to aid the efforts of low-income students to better understand their college options and opportunities, particularly opportunities at selective colleges and universities. The foundation, which Levy describes as, quote, the largest college scholarship foundation in the United States, is working with technology partners to build a college search engine and online advising tool specifically designed for first-generation college students. Levy promises aggressive efforts to promote these new tools, quote, we will market this using every one of the honed tactics of the for-profit colleges, end quote. Harold Levy, thank you for joining us. You're the executive director, as I said, of the Jack Kent Cook Foundation. Also in our conversation is Scott Jasek, co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. So, Harold Levy, let me begin by asking politely, there are a lot of technology tools from a variety of different sources out there in the marketplace already intended to aid and assist college students understand the college process, understand financial aid, understand access and opportunities. What is it that the foundation sees as not happening, and what is it the foundation hopes will happen with this new tool, with this new initiative?
Well, first off, thank you for having me on. The foundation took a look at what was actually available, and it turns out that while there are a great number of tools, they're pretty disparate, and they're hard to find, and they're also siloed. What we thought made sense was to try and bring as many of these together as we could, and also to give it a kind of technology that would make it easily accessible to students all across the country. The opportunity here is to fill gaps. There are a lot of white spots in between points of light, and what we want to do is make this seamless so that students have essentially one-stop shopping, that they can go and find what they need in one place. So right now, for instance, there are rankings by perhaps a dozen different college ranking surveys. U.S. News and World Report is the most famous. There's Washington Monthly. The New York Times has just started one. Forbes has one. If you want to know what you're going to be, how much you're going to make when you get out, you go to Forbes. If you want to find out what other peer groups think, you go to U.S. News. If you want to find out how they're doing with low-income kids, you might go to the New York Times site. What I'd like to do is figure out a way that we can begin to collect that information in one spot, A, and B, make it in a user-friendly format, something akin to the way you interact with Siri. Those two opportunities are potentially a showstopper, and I think is a real service, not only to our direct constituents, which is the high-performing low-income kid, but by happenstance, also everybody else.
So when you said earlier, a few moments ago, that you want to bring this together, is this a matter of aggregating what's there and filling in the gaps, or is the foundation really going to just aggregate the information as opposed to the applications that currently exist and build something new?
Well, that's a very good question, and it's still a work in progress. It's going to be a hybrid, some and some. We've been in discussions with both the technologists and with some of the existing sources of information, and with some people who can parallel what exists. Some of these databases are not hard to emulate. Some are very hard. We would have to do either approximations or work collaborations. But the exercise is to take a run at being one-stop shopping. As I indicated, we're not there yet. So stay tuned, and when we have something to roll out, I hope it will be the kind of thing that will get real attention.
Scott Jasek, you watch a lot of this stuff in terms of admission and how this market has changed. Is Is there, as Harold Levy suggests, a lot of white space between these various applications?
I would say yes, and a lot of it has to do not with the applications and the rankings that exist, but with one of the greatest forms of inequality, I would say, for high school students going to college is in the area of getting good information and guidance. If you look at things like the ratios of guidance counselor to student or students to guidance counselor, you will see that if you go to a good suburban school or a private school, you have a huge advantage over others in terms of access to information. Not the fault of the very good counselors working in low-income schools, but they've got too many students. Then you add in the fact that the students going to the better, you know, financed suburban and private schools probably have a lot of connections through family and friends. You have a further disadvantage. So while there is a lot of, you can rank everything from, you know, the things Harold mentioned to the best places for a vegan student, there it is much harder to get good, solid information. What's the right college for me? How am I going to pay for it? Does this institution want me?
So, Harold, the access to information is one part of the college-going thing, but there's also this, that as Scott said and as you said, you know, students who come from more affluent communities and have a background with college, there's a lot of high touch about that process in terms of counseling and information from peers. Is high tech going to be enough for this? Where is the high touch or the tech-enabled high touch part of the foundation's initiative?
So let's do a little bit of a division here, and let's think of this as a continuum. Scott's got it exactly right. At one end, there's the $40,000 a year Park Avenue counselor that you can buy the services of, and they do handholding. They make calls to admissions committees. They help you write your essay, and I suppose in the worst case, they write it for you. That's at one extreme. There are very few people who can afford that kind of thing. At the other extreme is the kid in a large urban high school who's a real standout but can never get to see the guidance counselor because either they don't exist or the guidance counselor is so overwhelmed by a caseload as to be, you know, as to have 3 minutes for the kid once a year, once a lifetime, and that's your guidance counseling for picking a college. And let me say, just on that, and it's a sadness, but it is still true, I believe, in many jurisdictions in this country, the only way that a principal can take out a teacher involuntarily who is doing harm, who that principal perceives as affirmatively doing harm in the classroom, is to make them a guidance counselor. That's unbelievably bad. So what I have in mind is an interactive system that's a first cut at this. It's no substitute for the high-touch, individualized human being sitting opposite you trying to coax out of you what are your inner thoughts, what are your real desires, what's the vision you have of how you go to college. But boy, is it a help for the kid who's got nothing. For that kid, it's a lifesaver. That's what we're hoping to do.
And Scott, I mean, again, you know, we think about what the counseling looks like. Will that first tier be sufficient, do you think, given what we know about college access, particularly with low-income students where there's no history of college and the competition, particularly for the very institutions that Harold Levy talks about in terms of helping high-ability students bridge the gap in terms of the undermatch, whose abilities might lend them an opportunity to go to a more selective or prestigious institution, but just don't see that opportunity on the screen or in the college counseling that they're getting, if they're getting any at all.
Well, it may be important in this debate to not let perfection be the enemy of substantial improvement. The overall problems of inequity in American society and in American education are not going to go away with any one single service or new tech tool. But because there's so much evidence about the problem, in terms of, for instance, colleges that will all visit the same elite high schools and ignore the high schools that don't have large numbers of well-prepared students, there's a huge problem out there. And the reality is colleges say that they want more low-income students. They say they want more minority students. They can't get that just by going to a few charter and magnet schools that they've identified as being good. They have to find ways to reach the standout student who's at a high school where maybe every student is not a standout student. And colleges have shown themselves thus far largely unwilling to visit those high schools, to engage in those high schools. States are unwilling to pay for enough guidance counselors at those high schools. So I have no idea if this will work, as Harold suggests, but there is such a problem that it strikes me that a lot of people will want to see experiments, see what happens, and build on them.
Right, and Harold, leaving along the lines of the issue of experiments, is the initial announcements made this sound like it's all technology. Is the foundation's plan to work with existing organizations or help create new ones that will provide some of that tech-enabled high-touch experience as part of the college counseling and access experience?
So the answer is yes to both. As I tried to suggest before, it's a hybrid. We're going to, on the one hand, use the best of the for-profit technology. Let me give some examples. The technology that you get when you, say, call up Verizon is light years different than if you call up one of our colleges. And the initial screen is often, as we've all experienced, done by a machine. That's the kind of thing that is completely absent in the college setting. In addition, it turns out we have lots of data to understand how those initial screens work, where they're successful and where they're not. Well, it's not ever going to be, what I have in mind and what we're building is not ever going to be a substitute for a solid guidance counselor. No one's going to make the claim that a machine is going to be that complete substitute. This notion of not being able to discern the difference, and that at some point you get a, quote, singularity, I think is fanciful. But having said that, we clearly are approaching something that does really communicate, really have vast data to draw on. And, you know, we only have to go so far as to think of how Apple has succeeded with Siri to know that this can be a valuable tool. And what Scott says is absolutely right. The need is so great. The demand is so huge. You only need to talk to one of these kids who narrowly escapes falling off the cliff of not getting into college at all. High-performing, low-income kids are in a precarious state, not because they're not smart, but because there are so many obstacles in front of them, and no one gives you the 101 course on here's what life is about, and let me explain how you apply to colleges, and here's how you strategically position yourself. Everybody works that out for themselves, and everyone has a story. What I want to make sure is that the high-performing kid gets something in the nature of guidance counseling, something in the nature of help. And candidly, we all need that. For some of us, you then go on to an individual counselor who can actually help you. For other kids, that's all they're ever going to get. That's what we have to address.
I want to come back to the issue of what you called the well-honed marketing tactics of the for-profit colleges. They have been pilloried in terms of issues of access and opportunity, or the promise of, or the pretense of false opportunity, and yet they are very successful in recruiting low-income, often minority students. What is it that they do well beyond just the phone trees that you alluded to earlier that other institutions can learn and adapt, and the foundation plans to do as part of very aggressive marketing for this new initiative?
Well, I mean, there's a, you know, if you take a step back and you say, how do good businesses get successful? There are two answers, right? One is marketing, and one is the substance of their product. One is viral by virtue of people, you know, elbowing one another and say, boy, you got to try that. And another is to put your name out there and do it in a very vigorous way. You're right that many of the for-profits don't have a lot to write home about in terms of substance, but boy, are they successful. So you got to ask, what are they doing right? And many of the nonprofit colleges have now begun to adopt some of the marketing techniques, online marketing, identifying cohorts, going to aggregator sites, using very finely honed hot transfer techniques. There are all kinds of things that have been done that get people to apply and get their name out. And there are now companies that advise the nonprofit colleges and basically run similar programs for them. You know, the Comcourse comes to mind, MBNET, there are a bunch of others. There's no reason, and I'm familiar with this because for many years I was investing in for-profit colleges, and before that I was executive vice president of Kaplan, where I helped start Kaplan University.
Harold, let me turn to Scott on this, though, because for adults who might have access to a computer screen, this system seems to be a portal in. But one of the obvious concerns that many have about resources for high school students in impoverished communities is that there is no readily accessible screen. Scott, let me throw that one at you in terms of access to the enabling technology that would provide a way in to the resources that Harold's talking about.
Sure. Well, I'm not sure how Harold envisions this happening, but certainly what we have been reporting that in low-income communities, the smartphone actually is the tool of choice, and how many of these students have access to the internet and to everything that's on the internet. So even if many low-income students don't have these tools, you know, don't have a great perfect laptop or iPad or whatever at home, they are using smartphones, and frequently they have access to shared computers in their school. So there is not a gap in access. Well, there's a gap in quality of access to the internet, but low-income students have smartphones. If it's the right information presented appropriately, they can get information online.
Harold, smartphones is part of the plan?
Absolutely. That's why we're talking about using a Siri-type access point, because that's built for this kind of technology. And let me say, you know, what Insight has been reporting is absolutely right, and we all know that there's still a poverty of, you know, there's a digital divide and there's a poverty of access to the internet. That's part of the thing that we're trying to overcome here, right? It is the case that kids have access to have smartphones, and that's the way to get in. But it is also the case that we've seen data that shared access to the computer is now much more widespread, and the digital divide is coming in. And that, let me say, is in part thanks to the broadband movement, the E-Rite, that has, that this administration has pushed so successfully. We are getting to the point where the digital divide has come in very considerably. And if we can get their attention, and if we can provide the information on a mobile platform, then being able to do additional research on a shared facility is not beyond the pale. We're looking for the kids who've got grit, who are going to be persistent. Go ahead.
All right. And what will be the metrics for success 3 and 5 years from now?
I have high hopes that this will change the nature of college selection in America. I want to democratize it in a way that it isn't today. Our aspirations are not small.
And Scott, when you write about this for 3 or 5 years from now for Inside Higher Ed, what metrics will you be using in terms of looking for the success of this initiative?
I would be looking at low-income high schools that aren't currently sending large shares to colleges or to top colleges, but have interacted with these new tools, and look and see if the numbers have changed.
Great. Harold Levy, thank you for joining us.
Scott
Kostick, thank you. Also, our thanks to Kathy Davidson, who joined us from City University of New York for our program. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is available as an audio stream or podcast early afternoon on most Fridays. On the web, we are available at insidehighered.com/thisweek. Please share your thoughts about this week with us on the comments section of the webpage. Thank you.
Join us for the next edition of This Week at Inside Higher Ed. Funding for This Week is provided by 2U, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, and Oracle. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is a production of G2 Education. Executive producer is Ginny Goldstein. Technical support is provided by Learning Times.